I would, as I did last week, urge all of you to join the Institute and support it both by membership and, I might add, all donations are gratefully received. This evening, I'm very pleased to introduce to you Professor John Dunn, who is Fellow of King's College, Cambridge, and a reader in politics at Cambridge. Professor Dunn is a graduate of Cambridge University and also was a fellow at Harvard University. He is the author of a number of works which are, in a sense, interdisciplinary in that they relate history, political science, and philosophy. He will speak to you this evening on envy, fear, and interdependence, the Third World and the West. Professor Dunn.
Thank you very much. What I want to claim this evening, stated in a nutshell, is that the present world order, economically and politically, does not offer, and its continuation through time, does not offer a viable future for the human species either morally or practically. But I shan't be talking at that level of generality for much of the time, and I shan't, on the whole, be quite that portentous again until perhaps the very end. The issue which I have at the back of my mind this evening, and towards which my title gestures so airily, is an extremely grandiose one. Are there any terms on which the world and men being taken as they now are, the human species could come to share the world and its resources in security and mutual trust for a lengthy future? And if there are any such terms, are there any broad lines of action which will make it more likely that these terms will in due course come to be realized? These are questions of such enormity that none of us can know their answer. We shall just have to wait and see. And there are certainly questions which I lack the nerve or the arrogance to address directly. But they are also questions which if we are rational and moderately informed creatures, press upon us now with the greatest urgency. Ever since the formation of the OPEC cartel, a painful but instructive happening, it has been obvious that the dynamics of the world economy are exquisitely vulnerable to quite narrowly political intentions. And that certainly is just the beginning of it. In a world so densely interdependent, the extent of our mutual political distaste and resentment and fear looks a very dense and practical threat. And except at the level of verbal placebos, we have strikingly little idea of what, if anything, is to be done to lessen the menace. I begin with these somewhat histrionic thoughts because I want to talk at first in a rather self-indulgently autobiographical vein, not about broad theme, which is the real subject I wish to treat, roughly how it makes sense for us to see the Third World, what the existence of those populations should or must mean to us today, but rather about how I came to think and feel about this question as I now do. This is obviously a very egocentric way of considering the issues, and I felt it would be offensively and imprudently egocentric to begin this way without taking the precaution of invoking matters of blatantly broader significance as the occasion and excuse for my self-centered mutterings. Whether there will or will not be a world for our children's children's children to inhabit in some security and freedom and joy is a question which one does not, I think, need to apologize for addressing as best one can. And there is at least honesty in addition.
There seems to be some problems. Thank you.
Won't they clash, in fact?
As I was saying, there is at least honesty, in addition to whatever vanity you may feel there to be, in acknowledging the limited progress which I have so far made in thinking about these questions and speaking about them more in the idiom of intellectual autobiography than in that of academic authority or pseudo-authority. There are really no authorities in these matters. It would be delightful to be in a position to tell you exactly how you ought to see the world, but to speak so confidently and didactically, I should certainly need to be a great deal more sure how I saw it myself, of the stability and validity of my own judgment. As it is, all I can really hope to do, with any honesty, is to describe the development of my own imagination in relation to these questions, and to seek, perhaps optimistically, to tug your imaginations a little more in the same direction than the course of everyday Vancouver life, or for that matter, everyday Cambridge life, would be likely to stretch them on its own. We shall come back to the grand questions of political theory and historical understanding, and to the brutal practical issues of what, if anything, is to be done to preserve the earth as a human habitat and human life within it as fully human in dignity in due course. But first, as I've warned, I wish to trespass on your patience by narrowing the shutter of the lens very sharply and focusing on a relatively small area of West Africa, the state of Ghana. It is a little under 10 years ago now since I first stepped out of the aeroplane at the airport outside Accra, Ghana's capital, into the hot and sodden cotton wool atmosphere and the chaos of Ghanaian officialdom at work. The airport at that time was fairly rudimentary, and the terminal buildings with the seedy airport hotel were distinctly grey and green in vintage and style, cramped and decaying, with occasional ineffectual fans stirring the hot, dense and damp atmosphere and the flies. Today, or to be more punctilious, 3 years ago, when I last made a visit, and presumably today also, there is a large modern plate glass terminal building, such as one could now expect to find in any moderately prosperous country in the world, and named after the army officer who led the military coup which displaced the government of Kwame Nkrumah and who was himself murdered a year later in an abortive second coup, General Kotaka. The coup of February 1966, staged in Nkrumah's absence on a mission to Hanoi to solve the Vietnam problem, came as somewhat of a surprise to most people in Ghana or outside. Not to be sure, because of the overwhelming popularity of the Nkrumah regime or any towering social, political and economic achievements which it had to its credit, but simply because Nkrumah had ruled the country for over a decade and because he had an extremely powerful political presence. Apart from his relatively direct clients, the beneficiaries of office within his governing political party, the CPP, few Ghanaians at that time still regarded him with keen affection. But many, perhaps even most, felt towards him a combination of fear and awe, a prudent anxiety, for which the standard Ghanaian term normally translates into English as respect. He was a very formidable figure, and Ghana will not look on his like again in a hurry. For a few years, he turned his prosperous and easygoing little country into a cynosure for the African continent as a whole, setting the pace for British decolonization, and by the demonstration effect of this, for decolonization by other European powers, and conjuring up out of nothing the first organization for continental cooperation for the new states of Africa. By the end of his reign, the word reign comes naturally, he had become a sadly solitary figure, at odds with all his territorial neighbours, his foreign policy shrunk to the dimensions of pan-Africanism in one country, and the economy of that country in ruins. Always corrupt and incompetent, His rule in its last years became increasingly tyrannical and destructive in its economic and social effects. But for a decade and more, Showboy, as his followers still fondly refer to him today, had turned the eyes of the world onto Ghana, a country of no importance, and had made it count for something in the world. It is never likely to count in this way again. And now that Nkrumah has died in exile and much subsequent blood has gone under the bridge, a certain nostalgia has seeped back into the feelings of many. The military action which removed Nkrumah's government in February 1966 was not the first subversive political initiative emanating from inside the army, but it was certainly the first such initiative which looked at all practical and serious. Since February 1966, there have been many more such military initiatives of varying degrees of plausibility. And the one democratically elected government which Ghana has enjoyed since Nkrumah abandoned the holding of competitive elections was summarily removed by military action within 3 years of its election. The present military government of Ghana, entitled with fetching ambiguity the National Redemption Council, is under active pressure to throw in the towel from professional associations, from university students, from industrial workers, and I suspect increasingly from within the ranks of the army itself. The state of the economy has gone from extremely bad to drastically worse, with almost Weimar rates of inflation, particularly in the prices of locally produced foodstuffs, and with a growing risk of famine in large areas of the country, generated not so much by climatic misfortune as by protracted and grotesque economic mismanagement. When I first visited Ghana in 1968, it was a rather happy, unviolent, tolerant, and friendly society, a good deal less racist in tone than Great Britain even then, a society which had passed through colonial rule without apparently experiencing any great trauma in the course of doing so. Today, it is a sorry and bitter country, frightened and angry, devoid of any great hope in the future, and without much grounds for such hope either. Bad luck, of course, has had some part to play in the story. The OPEC cartel has hit the economies of agricultural producers with largely land-based transport systems like that of Ghana very hard indeed, unless they happen to fall on the right side of the cartel line. Oil, Sheikh Yamani notes, comes from God, and it is hardly the fault of Ghanaian actors or of their former colonial rulers that God did not elect to deposit it in any great quantity beneath the soil of Ghana. Bad judgment on the part of Ghanaian political actors, from Nkrumah himself to General Champong, the present incumbent, has played a very substantial part in it too. And unambiguously vicious conduct on the part of persons in power has made a decided contribution of its own. But it is not simply as a record in this sense of crimes and follies and misfortunes, a flat, externally viewed history of a foreign scene, that I wish to consider this trajectory now, but rather as a puzzle within the life, imaginative in the first instance, in the present, but also practical enough in the end, of societies like yours and mine. What does this sad story signify for us? Does it, in the first instance, signify anything at all? And if it does do so, or should do so, what ought or could it mean for us, besides simply yet another record, like most other records of human social action throughout time and place, of the vices and errors of others? Evasively, I don't as yet wish to try to answer this question, and to add imprudence to evasion, I want, before I make any attempt to do so, to revert briefly to a more blatantly autobiographical vein and say a little about why I ever went to Ghana myself in the first place. There are considerably more elegant and prepossessing ways of presenting the explanation of this geographical caprice, but I think on the whole it would be better to speak as frankly as I can. The best date to begin, I think, is in the year 1956, at the time of the British invasion of Suez, a time at which I was living briefly in the Indian capital of New Delhi, because my father, a career army officer, was serving as military advisor in the British High Commission. We had a great many Indian friends, mostly soldiers and their families, some of the former having been friends of my father's for several decades, ever since they had served together in the Indian Army before the last war. To add a historical tag, the unit to which my father, an artillery officer, had been seconded at that time was the first unit of the Indian Army since the Indian Mutiny of 1857 to be permitted to possess modern artillery, and no less than three of the Indian officers with whom he had served as a lieutenant were subsequently, after the independence of India, to become commanders-in-chief of the Indian Army, a big army in a big country. Relations between my father and his Indian military friends seemed really very close and affable, as close and affable, certainly, as any he had sustained before or was to sustain subsequently with colleagues within the British Army itself. The residue of an imperial military culture seemed a relaxed and self-subsistent style of life. But at the time of the British invasion of Suez, matters did become a little more strained. As was scarcely remarkable, the British were in extremely bad odour in New Delhi at the time, an odour to which, in my view, they were rather richly entitled. And my father, a man of the right by any standards, was perhaps more drastically insensitive to the demerits of British conduct at the time than even the majority of British military representatives in diplomatic posts abroad. Certainly, at that time, even as it seemed to me, the ripe tolerance which his Indian friends in general displayed towards my father's jolly but rather hectoring style of sociability was coming under very evident strain. As a somewhat priggish adolescent, my main overt concern at the time was with the moral and cultural limitations of my father's view of politics. But even as a rather priggish adolescent, it was difficult wholly to miss the sheer weirdness of the cultural mélange which confronted me, the astonishing range of viewpoints and imaginations and mutual incomprehensions and self-righteousnesses which made up the political responses of those around me. Even living in India at that age necessarily made a considerable impression. A country which not merely looked and smelt and felt so unutterably different from England or France or Germany or anywhere I'd ever been before, but in which poverty and hunger, to a degree that I could not clearly imagine even when I could clearly see it, thronged around me on every side, and in which it was literally true that one might stumble in almost any street, at almost any time, on someone who had in fact starved to death. Simply existing in the midst of all this, surveying it from the comfort of a spacious flat in the diplomatic enclave of New Delhi, was, I think in retrospect, bound at that age to leave me with a rather deeper sense of the world as moral chaos, of the relationship between societies within it is grotesquely beyond the reach of justification or ethical acceptance than comes to most people who grow up in industrial societies in peacetime. It wasn't at all a sense of human wickedness, of the dreadful potential extremity of evil intentional action, as this was drawn, for example, by the victims of German military occupation in the course of the last war, but simply a sense of the aching chasm between the comfort, material and perhaps more importantly moral, of my own past life and the emaciated human beings with whom, quite casually and unmaliciously on both sides, I was for a little sharing the streets of the city. Seeing all this, it was difficult at the time to do anything other than simply feel extremely guilty. And a life organized around such a feeling of guilt, a sort of secularized missionary project of the voluntary aid agencies devoted to the nurturing of the peripheral guilt of other prosperous people and the channeling of the proceeds to the direst centers of international catastrophe, a life for Oxfam would have been a natural and, within its own terms, an edifying enough response to the feeling, certainly a response far more edifying than the agreeable and comfortable academic trajectory which I've since followed. But if simply being in such a poor country at such an age was perhaps almost guaranteed to change the way in which I felt about the world of nations and the relations between them, and bound to make the relations between them seem in many ways humanly more important and morally more pressing than the relations within my own domestic society of Great Britain, it was not, I think, simply exposure to such novelties which in the end has made such a difference to the way in which I think about politics and the human world, but rather the fact that it was really at that point that I began to think about politics. Simply to see the moral enormity of a human world which includes you and me and what are referred to readily enough and with increasingly literal accuracy as the starving millions, does not in itself necessarily prompt to any very elaborate thought, does not necessarily stimulate thinking at all. Such a world is more than anything else a world to deplore, not to interpret, but to change and change for the better, and the mood which it evokes is an international equivalent of Blanqui's stalwart, if mildly bovine, domestic proclamation, what exists is bad, something else must take its place. The political outcome of this mood is classically more than a little Manichaean, and if there is usually some evidential basis for the selection within it of the identity of the forces of darkness, little more than sheer wish fulfillment often serves to select what are to be seen as the forces of light. We are all, in temperament, Manichees after a fashion, splitting the good from the bad at whim and cleaving to these arbitrary identifications with the fervour of the self-converted. But no one is compelled to succumb completely to a Manichaean vision of the world as a totality. And the best protection to allowing our ego's mechanisms of defence to dominate our capacity to understand the world is the cultivation of scepticism and irony. If we cannot help but feel the world in some measure as the Zoroastrian battleground of light against darkness, we can at least learn to see it also as a stage for the enactment of the comic, the farcical, and the absurd. To see absurdity is certainly not enough, since the forces of darkness are indeed loose in the world and in ourselves, and exclusive concentration on the comic aspects of the human condition is both morally self-indulgent and practically hazardous. But I think it goes a little deeper than that. For a species obliged willy-nilly to attempt to learn to live in a world which is increasingly crowded, both imaginatively and practically, the cultivation of an imaginatively blinkered moralism may be at least equally dangerous. If it were really true that we must learn to love one another or die, we should no doubt simply have to resign ourselves to dying as best we could. But if, as seems a less sentimental expectation, we must learn to understand one another or die, the project seems less self-evidently beyond our collective powers. It would certainly involve an extraordinary cultural transformation. But unlike the vision of the human world as a community of love, it doesn't appear to require direct divine intervention in order to render it practically even conceivable, a categorical change in our conception of the attributes of men, even as they might be, let alone as they are in the least bit likely to become. To see the world with irony as well as with concern may thus genuinely prove an aid in the quest for political understanding, a quest in which it is always at least as important to assess with accuracy what can or cannot be done as to identify with confidence what it would be desirable to be able to do. A narrowly Manichaean vision is inherently casual about causal capabilities and over-focused on the exercise of moral will. It calls us importunately to stiffen the sinews and summon up the blood to a struggle to the death. Now, in purely psychological terms, I was, I think, eminently well prepared by the contingencies of biography for a rigidly Manichaean political sensibility. A hectoring right-wing father is a classic recipe for creating a hectoring left-wing son. And whatever else a passage to India had done for me, it had certainly made me take the structure of society and the coexistence of such appalling existential inequalities very hard. Had I spent my entire adolescence inside the British Isles and had my father's political opinions been essentially domestic in focus, been confined to a narrowly Poujadiste hostility to the incursions of the Inland Revenue Service and an excessive preparedness, albeit one unsurprising in an artillery officer, to greet the early signs of industrial unrest with a whiff of grape shot, it seems more than probable that I would have learnt a splendidly rigid leftist perceptual style. But in practice, the absurdity of my own family's self-image and objective social location came out in the Indian context too blatantly for even the most priggish of adolescents wholly to miss it. Much in the style of Professor Trevor Roper's Declining Gentry, my family liked to think of itself as having been downwardly socially mobile since roughly the Norman Conquest. As might be anticipated on such a lengthy downward slope, all material trace of gentility had in practice long since evaporated. As many very downwardly socially mobile gentry families had done, it had become very much an imperial family, fighting in foreign wars and planting beverage plants in elevated countryside in southern India or Assam or Kenya, and sustaining a fair parody of the gentry lifestyle as professional army officers on horseback or in the dedicated slaughter of birds and dumb animals the world over. Seeing my own, as an adolescent, my own place within the British class structure in this way with a certain helpless irony, I found it difficult even then to regard the class politics of my own society without a measure of distance, a mild snigger. It was all rather different from the domestic political regime on which the young Lenin honed up his political emotions. In the Indian context, too, my family's protracted involvement with the extra-European world did show up to better advantage, even if its favoured categories of interpretation of the realities of this world or of the character of its own relations with it seemed, if anything, even more bizarre than they had within the British Isles. And in New Delhi in 1956, where my father's responses to the British invasion of Suez were plainly as much a source of embarrassment to his Indian friends as they could be to any adolescent son, it was a good deal easier than it could have been inside the British Isles to perceive them as a product of incomprehension rather than simply dispositional wickedness. No doubt it helped a bit that my father was not merely an extremely overbearing man, but also rather a nice one. But in imaginative terms, it certainly helped more to be thrust at such an age and in such a mood and in such physical surroundings into the midst of such an extraordinary range of cultural viewpoints. It is a very old fantasy in ethics and in political theory, reaching back at least to Plato, that virtue is knowledge, and thus that there cannot be vice without ignorance, that the only reason why people ever do wrong is because they simply do not understand what they are doing. And it is, I think, however, morally and imaginatively seductive, very plainly a fantasy. If there really are any human desires at all, we can be pretty certain that some of them are desires which, if satisfied, will inflict pain on others. But even if it is sadly false as a general doctrine about the nature of virtue or the causes of human vice, there is still some wisdom in the insight that a great deal of the suffering in human existence and the damage caused by human conduct is caused gratuitously by mutual human incomprehension, not by the fact that we do not care what we do, but by the, in principle at least, more corrigible consideration that we do not altogether understand much of it. After this lengthy and, I fear, somewhat self-indulgent detour, let us return now to Ghana, that politically and economically decaying corner of West Africa, and ask again what its fate, however unenviable, can reasonably be supposed to do with us, or, to speak more honestly, with you. Ghana may indeed be today in trouble, but what possible concern could this be to the citizens of British Columbia? Great Britain may be unable to sustain its own economy or indeed its own polity, but it can amuse itself, if it so chooses, with the luxury of bemoaning its imperial past, now vanished. The profits may have seeped away beyond recall, but at least we can still savour the shame. But Western Canada a younger, more innocent, more capable, and less emotionally, perhaps, self-indulgent land, need hardly concern itself with such contorted sentiments. Canada draws few, if any, direct profits from Ghana, and it has, as it happens, a very respectable record in the dispersing of aid in Ghana, providing large areas of the Ghanaian countryside for the first time with supplies of clean piped water, a social and economic good as palpable and unambivalent as one could readily find in the country's recent history. And in any case, what is there to be so morally anxious about in Ghana's present predicament? The famine is mostly yet to come. The gutters of Accra are not running with blood. A Belgian studying the history of Burundi since colonial rule came to an end, or for that matter, an Englishman studying the history of Uganda over the same period would be fairly dull of soul if they were not stricken with some dismay. But for a citizen of Western Canada, so very far away from Ghana, so very lightly linked economically to that country, to feel much moral queasiness at its present fate would surely be morally more than a little hysterical. What else could Western Canada sensibly have to do with Ghana? What other relations could it sanely sustain besides those which it does already? The buying of cocoa, at present at a historically most satisfactory price, for its children's chocolate bars, and the paying out of an agreeably indiscernible cess in its ordinary federal tax load to give clean water to the Ghanaian countryside and its inhabitants. I emphasize this happily unbesmirched moral balance sheet with some tenacity, precisely because the questions which I want to address are questions not best addressed in the accusatory mode at all. As far as Ghana is concerned, the British may well belong in some dock or other, though it will hardly much improve their capacity to act decently in the future to be assured so now. But in any case, none of the problems of Ghana today could possibly be attributed to criminal acts on the part of Western Canadians. And the case which I wish to argue is not that the condition of Ghana is a proper basis for shame on the part of Western Canada, but rather that the condition of the humanly inhabited world as a whole is a proper object of shame on the part of the human species as a whole, as well as being, as I said, practically very hazardous. Let me then go on from there. In what sense is the predicament of Ghana, as this is today, anything whatever to do with those who have the good fortune to live in Vancouver? On its former colonial masters, it might well appear to throw some measure of discredit as a belated proof of damage done long ago, a token of emergent pollution. But how could it in the least concern you? There are really two different types of answer to this question, both of which are moral in force in what they imply, however vaguely, is to be done. But one of them is more or less exclusively moral, and somewhat simple-mindedly so, while the other, the more causally elaborate, readily also lapses into moral contumely. The first, very broadly, is that Ghanaians are indeed human, are indeed in trouble, that we know this at a casual level and can only avoid knowing it at a considerably deeper level by conscious or unconscious choice, simply electing not to know and thus not to care about the suffering of people, about whose suffering, since they are as human as we are, and since we could know about it if we chose, we could and ought to know and care. There are certainly no resources for resisting this line of argument within the Christian religious tradition, and since the Western moral tradition as a whole is simply a secularized version of the Christian religious tradition, there are no conceptually very impressive resources in the Western moral tradition for resisting it either. Morally, if recognized at all, it is plainly beyond all defense, simply another token of the gross disparity between what morally should be the case and what practically is, which we all come to expect, and over which few of us, in consequence, feel greatly troubled. That's life. The second answer, the more causally elaborate, in the first instance simply asserts, more or less blankly, that the predicament of Ghana today and the felicity of Western Canada today, together both emerge from, have both been generated by a single process of economic and political development throughout the world, the expansion of capitalist production in the last few centuries, that the base of Canadian prosperity and the base of Ghanaian deprivation is not, as geographically appears to be the case, two quite different societies with two quite different histories in two quite different places, but rather a single base, a single field of social and political and economic relations which stretches across the globe. Of course, it's none too clear what this last allegation actually means, and it's easy enough to interpret it as indicating that the deprivation of the deprived is caused by the felicity of the fortunate, and that the suffering of the former is thus the fault of the wicked conduct of the latter. Such a picture has much appeal to the sons of Marni, whether they be conscientious Western adolescents, ashamed of their personal comfort, or relatively unscrupulous third world diplomats, only too delighted with their personal standards of consumption, and conscious that they are onto a quite unanswerable line of moral abuse. Since the internal social and political relations of the countries of the third world are mostly too unedifying to bear close examination, and since their governments are in any case increasingly unprepared to tolerate even rather distant examination of these relations, the possession of such an all-weather, all-season idiom of justified moral aggression is quite a considerable resource, especially diplomatically. But no one likes being subjected to extended moral vituperation, and it's not surprising that the capitalist West should thus far have drawn little moral inspiration from its exposure to these tirades. And it doesn't require a very inventive dialectical talent for Western diplomats and statesmen to riposte to these attacks with some kind of tu quoque, to talk of motes and beams in other persons' eyes, and relapse comfortably into an answering moral huff of their own. In the case of ex-colonial countries like Ghana, this tends to be especially easy, since the decolonization of these countries was rationalized morally by their former rulers in terms of the creation of local political institutions which would inherit and discharge the burdens which had previously been borne by their white tutelary masters. Responsibility for the social and economic residue of the colonial project was morally liquidated by devolving it onto local political actors to whom were imputed public goals compatible with those of the former colonial rulers, at least in the latter's own moral self-understanding. The rulers of independent Ghana took over the moral burden of the social, economic, and political structures created by colonial rule from the departing colonial rulers, along with the salaries. And if they have not discharged these with much moral distinction, they can have, or so it was hoped, no one else to blame for this sad state of affairs but themselves. If they had done their duties in the way that England expected, none of these lamentable consequences would ever have come about. Even the British can thus hope to wriggle off the moral hook on which Ghana's independent history has slyly sought to impale them. And if the British can wriggle off, how could the Western Canadians possibly remain thus impaled? But of course, the British are over-optimistic in their estimates of how likely they can hope to make their moral escape. For although the capacity of Ghana to affect any industrial country at all is extremely limited, a cocoa hold-up being a palpably less urgent form of political blackmail than the OPEC oil embargo, the converse is very far from holding. Ghana today is bound to the rest of the capitalist and, for that matter, state socialist world by 1,000 different sorts of bonds, some of them silken enough to be sure in themselves, but some of them harsh enough to chafe the most unfastidious. It is not merely that when one arrives at Accra, one arrives at an airport carried perhaps by Ghana Airways in a huge and expensive American jumbo jet operated permanently at an uneconomic load factor, nor that whenever one gets into a Ghanaian secondary school or reads a Ghanaian public document or attends a legal proceeding of any degree of seriousness, one finds that the language in which it is written or conducted happens to be English. It is not merely that in the more expensive city stores in Accra, a substantial proportion of the clientele just happened to be white, or that a considerable proportion of the Ghanaian higher civil service, university staff, professional personnel, lawyers, surveyors, doctors, senior army officers, and so on, happened to have been extensively trained abroad in England or in the United States of America or elsewhere. It is not merely that the buildings of Accra are imitations of foreign buildings, or that the institutions of government, administration and coercion, civil service, army, police, special branch, are direct continuations of colonial institutions, or that the national daily newspapers happen to be published in English. It is not merely that the bulk of the electricity generated by the giant Volta Dam at Acosombo goes to smelt alumina imported from the Caribbean by Kaisers and re-exported by them with virtually no linkage effects for the Ghanaian economy, while less than 100 miles away from the smelter itself, some of the largest bauxite deposits in the world remain unexploited. It is not simply that the broad shape of modern Ghanaian society is a product of the expansion of capitalist production within the extremely locally disadvantageous frame of a colonial regime, and that the resulting society was always, as even Nkrumah at his most intrepid acknowledged readily enough, devastatingly ill-placed to rescue itself from its own crippled and manacled state, even after political independence, to pull itself up by its own bootstraps. It is not simply, that is to say, the gross disparity in power and enjoyment between the populations of our own societies and that of Ghana, and the multiplicity of types of palpably unequal exchange which continue to link the two, the blunt injustice of the very complex field of force which joins us and them. Nor is it even the historical record of the transactions which have caused the appearance of modern Ghana as it is today, the more deliberate and less intricate or imaginatively opaque injustice of the past. Rather, it is the utter impotence of the best of our own political and social understanding, and of the best of the understanding which our cultural formation enables Ghanaians to arrive at for themselves, to identify a method of approach to the problems of Ghana which promises at all dependably to enable these to be met and surmounted, or indeed which shows even the least promise of preventing these from worsening ineluctably year after year after year within the present world order. The easy anti-imperialist socialist rhetoric of Dr. Nkrumah as he locked his political opponents away without trial and poured down the drain the public wealth which his cocoa farming subjects had accumulated, or the altogether primer and no less sanctimonious capitalist rhetoric of his opponent and democratically elected successor, Dr. Buzia, Prime Minister from 1969 to 1972, lending unhappily the tones of the lay preacher and the colonial DC, have both of them floated sonorously above a process of sickening and virtually uninterrupted economic decay, from the prosperity of the mid-1950s, when Ghana was one of the wealthiest societies in Africa, north of the Union, until today, when the degree of its ruin is matched by very few. I could make the point I wish to make readily enough by offering you a more elaborate vignette of Nkrumah or Buzia at work and play as their country fell apart around their ears. But since this isn't an academic occasion, I'll choose again a more personal example and tell you in hasty outline something of what occurred to a close friend of mine who was foolish enough to get his life muddled up with the projects of the Ghanaian state and its custodians. He was an academic lawyer by training, educated at university in Britain after he had completed his studies in Ghana, and for a fair amount of time he had served in an important post in the United Nations Secretariat in New York. He was a very clever and, in cultural terms, a very thoroughly déraciné young man. At the time at which I first met him, he was teaching the law school in the University of Ghana near Accra and just beginning to be involved in the frenzied political competition to determine what group was in fact going to lead the elected civilian political regime, which was due to succeed Nkrumah's military supplanters in the late summer of 1969. At first, he did little more than advise Buzia, and it's clear that at this time his advice was rather good. He certainly understood a lot about Ghanaian society and politics, though his political assumptions were, by the standards of my own country, extraordinarily right-wing, almost Victorian in character, and although some of his moral attitudes seemed even to me exceedingly exotic in the Ghanaian setting. I remember that he and Buzia were greatly concerned at the time
very presciently, as it turned out, though in Bouzier's own case either somewhat insincerely or pretty unself-knowingly, with the question of how the ministers in the new government could be prevented from thieving from the public till. In their instrumentally fairly rational preoccupation, Bouzier and he focused to a striking extent on the problems posed by Ghanaian sexual mores, the propensity of any successful Ghanaian to accumulate not merely a legal wife and family, but a suite of mistresses, all of whom required some measure of maintenance implication. Now, Ghanaians, on the whole, take the relations between power and politics and sex as easily and as much for granted as Machiavelli or the Restoration Court of Charles II. No doubt the expenses of sex were as powerful an incentive to the abuse of public office and the theft of public funds as all the other agreeable consumption perquisites of rank and power in Ghanaian society. Bouzier himself travelled around in a cavalcade which would have done no discredit to the ruler of Kuwait. But sprucing up the sexual mores of Ghanaian politicians was scarcely a promising point at which to commence one's efforts to improve the quality of Ghanaian public life. It was like exercising the stuffy moralism of Hammarskjöld on the clientele of a bordello. What happened to my friend afterwards is a very nasty cautionary tale. When Bouzier duly won the election by a huge margin and could concentrate his mind on how to keep the power which he had won, he decided that the key segment of the state, a segment which had in fact been very actively involved in this, he made a number of attempts to escape from the role in the next 2.25 years, first to go to Harvard, then to go to All Souls College, Oxford, as a visiting fellow. But on each occasion, Bouzier had little difficulty in persuading him that the state was too much in jeopardy to afford to lose his services and that his public responsibilities precluded his following his private interests. When the state's jeopardy matured in January 1972 and the Ghanaian army removed the Bouzier regime, his special branch subordinates duly came round, first of all, to my friend's house and beat him, as I had pointed out to him that they would when I was trying to persuade him not to accept the post in the first place. However, on this occasion, he was not especially severely injured, and he and his fellow members of the previous regime were let out of prison again within a relatively few months. Then, by misfortune or fecklessness, he got involved, or so it was alleged, on the fringes of an abortive plot to overthrow the military government, and the special branch returned to the house in a more agitated mood and beat him up a good deal more thoroughly. On this occasion, they actually beat one person to death in an amateurish excess of enthusiasm, and the government passed retrospective legislation making the offence of conspiracy against the state justiciable solely before a specially constituted military tribunal of 5 serving army officers, which was to reach its verdicts by a simple majority, and before which a verdict of guilty on the charge in question was to carry a mandatory death sentence. Shortly after this decree was passed, I had the dubious pleasure of meeting with the Ghanaian High Commissioner to the United Kingdom, a career diplomat and former student of my college in Cambridge, at some college festivity, while the government which he was representing was, as I supposed, flexing its muscles to shoot my friend. In the event, he wasn't actually shot. In political terms, Ghana is a quite exceptionally unbarbarous country, and its rulers have always been extremely reluctant to kill anyone on political grounds, even when the others are plainly in urgent need of encouragement. Instead, after a British QC had appeared unavailingly at his trial, and pleading letters from Oxford and Cambridge and Harvard, and no doubt other centres of legal high culture, had flooded in, the military government graciously commuted his sentence to life imprisonment, a fate which, being a person of courage and obstinacy, he ensured that he would continue to face until the regime changes by insisting on challenging the legality of the government's proceedings in one legal forum after another. At the level of a single individual, this is simply a very sad and wasteful outcome of devoting so much energy and talent to what he conceived of as the public service. But for me, it also epitomises the moral absurdity of the Ghanaian polity as a whole. Its ugly facticity, and the complete absence of coherent moral rationality which could guide its development for the better. The collision of the easy moral routines, either conservative or socialist, of the Western world with the political realities of Ghana simply brings out more clearly the moral hollowness and weightlessness of these routines. We have really no idea of what is to be done about Ghana as it is, and Ghanaians whose broad ideas about what is politically to be done are in fact drawn from us have equally little idea. Yet there Ghana is, on our television screens, in our balance of trade statistics, on the candy counters of our drug stores, on the cable records of our diplomatic legations. There it is, and it will not go away. But what is Ghana to do with us? It is, after all, another country, another state, to be polite, another nation. To cast it as an international beggar, a standing reproach to our consciences and our sense of charity, is certainly to insult it effectively enough, but scarcely to indicate what might practically be done to improve its condition. Moral reproach invites the more or less mechanical defence of one's own moral ego. What possible responsibility is it of ours? The nation-state is not merely a practical instrument for the protection and perpetuation of patterns of unequal control and enjoyment, the ways of life of actual communities in the world today. It is also, at least as importantly, an ideological device for focusing the moral responsibility of persons living in the world on a particular scale of shared social existence, defining just who for political purposes are to be seen as our brothers, and thus whom we may plausibly be expected, if the worst comes to the worst, to keep. Few who lose directly from it, in fact, enjoy the experience of redistributive taxation, and many manage pretty effortlessly to resent it. But redistributive taxation is a familiar aspect of modern social life, and it seems clear that few now regard it as either surprising or deplorable that they should be taxed in order for fellow citizens to be kept from starvation. Actual political community in the world today is mostly a pretty threadbare affair. But political community as an ideological project, the assumption that citizens, or at least the industrious and rational among them, owe one another at least a living, and in wealthy countries perhaps even a little modest ease, this pattern of sentiment is actively at work in politics today, and the practical efficacy of the nation state in protecting unequal control and enjoyment, its power, that is to say, depends upon paying, however hypocritically, this amount of practical homage to virtue. The question of how far rational political community was possible within a single state, the great question of 17th century political philosophers like Hobbes or Spinoza or Locke, is still a practically and morally teasing one. But there is no state in the world today morally insouciant enough to deny that this question, at least, is on the agenda. In the 17th century, rational political community within a single state was more than enough to ask, certainly more than was supplied. Between states, morality could be confined, or so it seemed, to the avoidance of intrinsically wicked actions, however the latter were conceived. Since states were conceived causally as creating, fashioning themselves, except insofar as they physically invaded one another, there was nothing blatantly fanciful in restricting responsibility between states to the avoidance of aggression. But the world in which we have to live is a very different world, a world in which we cannot honourably fail to recognise, or in my view, for very long, prudently fail to recognise, that the way in which societies are practically fashioned, shaped, caused to develop is not a nationally private matter, but a causal process which involves us all, whether we care for it or not. Now, honour, of course, is another very moralistic notion, and perhaps a notion drawn from a type of morality which seems a little archaic when inspected from inside a functioning capitalist society. But I think it's clear by now, though it may not have been so for terribly long, that what is in question is not merely honour, but the more accommodatingly egoistic value of prudence. Putting the point bluntly, we have simply got to learn to grasp more clearly what sort of world we are living in, if there is to be any prospect at all of our being permitted to continue to inhabit it in at all a civilized fashion. If we choose to restrict our understanding of the causal frame of our lives within a set of national boundaries, we are necessarily electing to live within a fool's paradise. It may be fun while it lasts, and it is difficult to know how long it could last for, certainly far longer in Western Canada than in Great Britain. But the longer it does last for, and the more fecklessly and uninhibitedly the fun is savoured, the steeper will be the reckoning which our descendants will have to pay. Paying later does not mean paying less. It means, in this case at any rate, paying with compound interest. If we ask, why did the Russian Revolution turn out so abominably? Why is Soviet power, the imputed power of the Russian proletariat, so close to the Mongol horde in the tank division? Why has socialism in practice proved such a disaster? The answer in outline, in my view, is simple enough. Having avoided so effectively the socialist transformation of civilized countries, countries in which socialism might have been possible, Western Europe and North America confront the consequences of the collapse of capitalism in societies in which a socialist civilization was quite certainly, at that time, impossible. Of course, we do not actually know that socialism was or is possible anywhere. And we do, I think, now know, very much against Marx's earlier expectations, that there is nothing at all ineluctable in the coming of socialism, that a worldwide barbarism is at least as real a possibility and perhaps an altogether likelier outcome. Nothing in the way in which the human social world is going, under its own steam, promises us any kind of happy future at all. The internal political and social dynamics of wealthy capitalist societies have already extended the social rights of citizenship vastly further than Marx would have supposed possible, and they have done so through ideological and practical political pressures upon the state. Because of the intrinsic ideological implausibility and moral vulnerability of the structure of capitalist societies, it is always possible to imagine this process extending in due course to their transformation into socialist societies. Such a transformation, which is definitely at issue in a number of Western European countries today, in Italy, in France, perhaps even in Britain, will be a painful and a desperately hazardous process. But it does remain, so far, a real possibility, and will, in my view, continue to remain such as long as there remain capitalist societies with extensive political and cultural freedom. The idea that civilization may emerge instead from societies which do not enjoy extensive political and cultural freedom need not, I think, detain us. I use socialism here fairly brazenly, simply as the name of what would be at last, for the first time in human history, a rational political community which could be seen and acknowledged as such without false belief by all its members. But such a community, if it were ever to appear, would still be a national political community, a bounded territorial and demographic unit in a world of other such bounded units. And the point of my nagging recital of the travails of Ghana is simply to insist that even the appearance of such a utopian political community, the Socialist Commonwealth of Canada, for example, the utmost optimism to which the traditions of political theory will at present stretch, is now already morally too little and far too late. The practical community in which we live now is a world community, a community of devastatingly uneven economic development and political division into a bizarre series of feudal appanages. To civilize a single barony within this feudal world, Canada as it might be, or England, is a worthy project in itself, but no one should mistake it for the establishment of a viable moral community. Around a century and a third ago, Karl Marx sketched out for the first time in the manuscript of the German ideology a picture of the creation of the globe as a single frame of action for the human species and hinted gnomically at the possibility of our building a real species community within it. True, the actual builders of the community were defined a little hastily as the proletariat, a grouping whom Marx saw as having the superstition gouged out of them by the ineluctable dynamics of capitalist development, a process which would purge the dross from the gold in the developed civilization and power of the species and leave the proletariat the proud possessors of the gold. Marx's vision, though that metaphor is perhaps a little too concrete, Marx's dream, at any rate, of a global species community was drastically rationalist, very much at odds with his sense of the dense facticity of social and economic practices in every actual society. It was a vision in which generosity effortlessly dominated greed, in which neither envy nor fear were allotted any very pressing object. Within particular capitalist societies, Marx at first saw civilization and accident proneness developing, if not side by side, at least in some degree of harmony. Social revolution within particular countries and the building of a fresh frame of social relations between countries were seen as posing no very firm obstacles to each other. Now, both of these views, the picture of structural conflict within capitalist societies and the picture of emergent global species community, have turned out to be, from Marx's point of view, over-optimistic, especially as to timing. But they have not, even in retrospect, come to look altogether absurd. What has come to look altogether absurd, however, is the view of their relatively effortless compatibility. The motto of all states in the world today, revolutionary or not, whether covertly or overtly, is what I have, I hold. It is imaginatively possible to some degree, and certainly, I fancy, technologically possible to at least an equal degree, for the human species to see its position in the world today as a whole, and its deepest and most permanent, its fixed interests, to use a 17th century phrase, as held in common. But in political terms, the species is organized and organized with enormous rigidity and intractability in a way which obstructs the development of such practical and imaginative community, which defines the interests of classes and of whole societies inflexibly at each other's expense and in the shortest possible run, and which backs this definition with overwhelming power. The key problem in practical reason for the species at present is a grandiose and baffling version of prisoner's dilemma, and we can escape it or solve it, if indeed it is still open to us to escape it or solve it at all, only by learning to understand and communicate more effectively with one another across borders, and to muster, as a result, the imagination to accept broader, more generous, and less hopelessly short-term definitions of our interests. Envy and fear are the psychic forces, the causal pressures, which we can guarantee will be in play in an interdependent capitalist world. But unless we contrive to supplement them with sentiments which recognize more generously that we are all indeed humans, there will be little chance of continuing to live together in any sort of practical community, as there would have been as little chance as there would have been of maintaining freedom and peace within operating capitalist societies which left the unequal powers of men on the market to determine literally every aspect of human existence, including sheer survival. Now, we shall hardly feel more generously towards one another unless we learn to understand one another a trifle better. And in the project of so learning, there is simply no part of the humanly inhabited world today so intrinsically absurd or so comfortably far away that we need know or care about it, not at all. Not even Garner.
Professor Dunn has indicated that he would be pleased to answer questions. Yes.
Mentioned multinationals, but what you did. And how they're brainwashed and how people get concerned, how get across people, how change can come. Change has to come everywhere. And like they want to act in Chile, like in Canada, people are giving refuge to getting refugees to get cheap labor, but they're not stopping Noranda mines. They're not stopping wine from or fruits come from Chile.
It's certainly part of my tune that change needs to come everywhere. I don't think I could do that. It's certainly part of my tune that change needs to come everywhere, and I also think that it's true that it's very unlikely that any more civilized pattern of social relations can be developed on the world scale unless, in fact, advanced capitalist countries become socialist countries. But I don't think it would be very sensible for me to give a lecture about the precise role in the integration of the international capitalist economy that's played by multinational corporations, because that's a very technical subject. And I don't think it's really necessarily enormously important for the issues that I want to talk about anyway. The question of whether advanced capitalist societies are politically fragile in a way which has any promising characteristics is very important for the subject I want to talk about, but I can't talk about everything at one time. No, I shouldn't think it's very likely to do so in and of itself. I was asked whether I thought another oil embargo would trigger off a worldwide war, and I think it's not very likely to do so. But that's only because nothing is very likely to do so. It might do so, I mean, it's as likely a way for it to begin as any of the other ways that people have dreamed up it might begin, and it might begin, that is certainly so.
You're talking about world disaster to a British Columbia audience. Can you give us step one to try to avert this disaster?
Well, I don't think I can give you step one. I mean, certainly I'd give the citizens of my own country all sorts of advice about what they might do immediately. But this place is a place I know too little about to be able to give very sensible advice. But certainly I think that it's the case that the expectation that the ways of life of wealthy capitalist communities can go on in the heedless fashion that they now exist into an indefinite future is profoundly morally and practically absurd. And the more people who understand that, the more likely it is that they will be bent slowly and painfully and uncomfortably in less lethal directions. I think I can answer at least the last part very easily and very frivolously, but I wouldn't attempt to justify it. I don't think it would be a sensible thing to attempt to justify. It's not part of what I have to say that I'm a morally admirable person. What I have to say is that the world cannot go on in the way in which it is currently printing itself out.
One off. What do you believe to be the moral standards capitalism today?
Well, I imagine it varies very much with the time and place. I mean, I don't think it, on a world scale that they're necessarily worse than they used to be, or better than they used to be.
One often hears it said, if you give the savages their freedom, that they will be at one another's throats in tribal wealth warfare and end up an oppressive dictatorships. And what, in fact, is the story? What is the score when people have less advanced states receive their freedom? Where are they going? Less democratic, more oppressive, or are they, is the score good or bad?
Well, it isn't on the whole easy to get less democratic than a colonial regime. I mean, it requires some application. So I wouldn't say that many of them were, in those particular terms, getting worse. But, of course, some of them have got worse in terms which are really much more urgent and drastic than that. I mean, there are several post-colonial states in Africa in which genocide has occurred, and, in fact, some in which it is still occurring. And, of course, that isn't something which one could be complacent about from the point of view of local political responsibilities. It's certainly the responsibility of leaders of African states that they shouldn't murder their populations.
The simplicity with which you have expressed such a complex problem is really one that worries me. And I don't know if you've come across or whatever intentions were to try to get such an audience sort of overnight after ideas change and try to go over tomorrow to the Foreign Affairs Department and say, let's try and share the wealth of our countries with the less developed countries. What I see as the essence of your talk is, do you believe that what you've said tonight, you're convinced that it will change? Or do you see another avenue of OPEC or the new economic order being something that the developed world should support?
Well, I don't myself believe that the sorts of cartels which you can get to work economically are likely to redistribute the wealth of the world in a very much more equitable way than it's currently distributed, although they may, of course, alter the distribution. I don't think that's a very optimistic prospect, and I don't myself also think that there's any reason to believe that out of the normal levels of political bargaining in international organisations, which produce a verbiage like the phrase, the new economic world order, any very drastic shift towards a less intolerable world is likely to come. It will only come at all, if it comes at all, by very drastic changes of intention and social organisation in the wealthiest countries in the world. But what I want to say is that I think that those changes are going to be forced upon us by a combination of moral and practical considerations, and if we resist the moral considerations, the sorts of practical resources we will be forced back to will not leave us with at all a nice society to live in. Yes, well, I don't really dissent very much from that.
It's a mistake the world is in right now. Because of the independence is successful. And it is also common knowledge that the economic dependence of third world countries on big problems is a stark reality. How would you account for political intervention? No matter how much political intervention the big power, which is an economic and third world country, and where the third world country depends on the economic base, and when is the political intervention and or cultural imperialism immorally right, and when should it stop? Like, for example, touching on boycotting wine if it comes from a certain country, that's an economic boycott. That's also political intervention, because let's say, for example, boycotting wine whatever Rhodesia exports to Canada, for example. That's a political intervention as well as an economic boycott. When is it going to be great?
Well,
Your question,
Yes, I think the gist of the question was, since there are many different sorts of practical relations, and since it's between advanced capitalist societies and the rest of the world, and since it's possible to react to these in a variety of different ways, is it justifiable to continue in effect to exercise a lot of control over such countries from the base of our wealth in formally economic ways, or is it, as it were, no more justifiable to do that than it is to politically oppress them? Is that roughly what you wanted to say?
It's just that there's so much tie up between political intervention and economic, I mean, political and economic aspects of any intervention of a big power into an old kind of a third world. In certain events that have happened in the third world, for example. Like, take one country, for example, like what I cite as an example. How are you going to intervene? And how can you just say, well, we're going to leave them as
bad?
Well, I don't think there is anything very general to be said about the precise forms of political pressure which it's desirable for one country to exercise on another, which isn't quite obviously trivial. I mean, there is a great... in any very intricate causal situation, in any situation in which there are a very large number of variables and there are a very large number of courses of possible action, it's just simply silly to say the general rule is X. There aren't general rules.
I think we should move on. Are there other questions? If not, I think perhaps we've imposed sufficiently on Professor Dunn. I would like to thank the Cecil and Ida Green Lectureship for bringing him to us this evening, and I'd like to ask Professor Hunter of the Department of History if he would thank Professor Dunn on our behalf.
It is sometimes the case on occasions like these that the thanks offered the speaker bears a relationship to his speech, something like the relationship between a camel and the proverbial eye of the needle. The evocation is so grossly inappropriate to the act because it's so much grander than the act. Well, I think we need not fear that to be the case tonight. I think Mr. Dunn's speech, and I think that I'm speaking for all of us, was elegant, provoking, sometimes disturbing, and I think for all of us, quite informative. I would think, too, that Mr. Dunn deserves thanks, as does the Cecil and Ida Green Professorships Committee and the Departments of History, Political Science, and Philosophy, which helped to bring him here. And finally, thanks to you for being such a good audience and asking questions and trying to push Mr. Dunn, as I think he deserves to be pushed. And so, for all of us and behalf of all of us, I'd like to say thanks for a fine talk.